Right, I do believe we're live.
Excellent. Hi, I'm Simon Mercep. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to popular entertainment in all its forms, with music and movies providing the main diet for myself and for Steve McCain.
And this week, Tom.
Yes.
It's Tom. Is he at the top of his game or is he, dare I say, cruising? comedy gold right there.
Kicking
off with comedy gold.
We'll wrap up the podcast right now. We won't record anymore.
Because that's, it's not going to get any better than that, is it? Oh, dear right. Lord. So that having been said, we are going to chat about Mission Impossible. Is there a punctuation in this or is it just Mission Impossible Fallout?
And I don't think I spotted a punctuation. There must be somewhere.
There's got to be. But would there be room for it among all the death-defying stunts? That's the question.
It is the question. We shall endeavour to find an answer. We'll also dive deep into the waters of the Aegean Sea and emerge somewhere near an island where they play ABBA music. That's my reference to Mamma Mia. Here we go again.
Sounds like an island I'd like to be honest.
Yes, yes.
Somewhere I don't think I'd want to go to on the strength of recent TV would be Wellington.
Right.
So we're going to have a quick chat about the first few episodes of Wellington Paranormal, which is the follow-on to What We Do in the Shadows, the new... Yeah. I mean, it's almost a vehicle, really, for Taika Waititi and Jermaine Clement.
It is, and there's a few interesting things to say about that. We're also going to talk about a Marvel movie, and this is a little different, a Marvel movie that hasn't made squillions of dollars. Does that mean, though, that Ant-Man and the Wasp lacks a little sting?
Ooh, see what you did there.
Yeah, it's not as good as your cruise, though. I've got a lot to live up to this week.
We peaked early. Peaked early. It's all downhill from there. So onward. Let's start with the film that opened this week. Now, unfortunately for me, it was actually a bit of an impossible mission getting to the screening for reasons that would take far too long to explain right now. But you made it there, didn't you?
I did. So this was it opens later this week, as you say, Steve. Luckily, I was able to attend a media preview at the IMAX cinema in Auckland, the massively big screen. And I'm sure that it really emphasised the action that was to be had here. This really was a full-on action extravaganza par excellence. Really, it was. Some of the most wonderfully crafted action sequences I think I've ever seen in any movie. I mean, just brilliantly shot, edited, the sound mixing, the sound effects, the dark, brooding, exciting music. This was just a massive dose of adrenaline pumped for about 2 hours. I was exhausted by the end of it. And it's the key thing to say here, Steve, I think, is regardless of what you might think about Tom Cruise, I would say see this film just to see the action sequences. I know that's a kind of a radical thing to say, but they're so good. I think there's a lot to be entertainment to be had just on that very visceral, basic level.
Call me old-fashioned, call me reactionary. Yes, I'm sure you're going to, but I like a film with plot.
You're going to be a bit disappointed, I think.
I had a feeling that was going to be the case.
The story here is really not that different from every other Mission Impossible story. We've got, in fact, the return of a villain from the previous movie. So the villain called Solomon Kane, played by Sean Harris, he returns. And the story really, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, Steve, but it's again one of those sort of rogue terrorist group out to wreak nuclear destruction type story. I mean, that's probably all I need to say.
So new ground is not really being broken here, then?
It's not, and you've got pretty much the same characters coming back again as in the previous film. The British actress, I think she's British, Rebecca Ferguson, returns as Elsa, and again as in the previous film. We're not sure about her motives and her allegiances, so that sort of plays out. We've got Simon Pegg back, Ving Rhames back. It's the same team, essentially, with a bit of tweaking. And apart from the action, Steve, the big difference in this film, and something was really noticeable, I thought, was the tone is very, very different. I think you'd agree that most of the other films have a fairly... There's a bit of a comic aspect to it, especially with Simon Pegg there. There's a bit of joking and laughing and...
Yes.
It's kind of lighthearted in many, many parts of the film. Much, much less so in this one. Much darker, grittier tone. the action is more of a visceral quality, like you'd see in a Jason Bourne or a Daniel Craig Bond type film. The music, wow. There's some really brooding and menacing music, almost like you'd see in a Christopher Nolan sort of a movie, or yep. Here in a Christopher Nolan. So I quite liked that, and I thought the action was fantastic. The story's the same, which leaves you with the question of Mr. Cruise and where he sits with you, and whether you think that all the baggage that you may have about Tom Cruise gets in the way of you enjoying a film like this. I was just able to put it aside and enjoy the action, but I don't know whether you would or not. I'm interested in it.
What possible baggage could one have for Tom Cruise?
What possible baggage could one have? What? Well, one might have a view about his allegiance to Scientology, perhaps. One might have a view about an apparent... I'll say apparent, an obvious ego the size of Mount Rushmore. I mean, he's in just about every shot. He's in just about every stunt. He does them fantastically well. You have to admire his stunt abilities. There's the ego has landed. I mean, that's kind of – he's renowned for being a control freak when it comes to making a film. So he's probably not an easy guy to work with. And he's kind of the same – in most films he's in. So is that enough baggage for you?
Well, I'd pick up on two bits of that. Yeah, I mean, first of all, you know, the Scientology thing is inherently creepy, obviously. And I can't imagine how much of our audience we've just alienated. But what I do know is I lived in Clearwater for 8 years and he never once came to visit me. So that right there obviously is a black mark. But yeah. Also, I think he could forgive an awful lot if he were a better actor.
That's a fair point. His range is not big, I agree. In this sort of action-type film, though, he's just required to look heroic and do heroic things. And in that score, he does it very well. I mean, he's had a lot of practice at it, Steve.
So what you're saying is, when he's not required to do anything, he's very good at it.
What can I say? There's not a lot of... We don't know a lot about the character he plays in Mission Impossible, really, do we? No, he was married at one point. And that role, Michelle Monaghan returns to play more of that role from previous films of his wife, but that Julia. But basically, he's kind of a—I don't mean this meanly, maybe I do. He's kind of a blank canvas in some ways.
Yes, he is, isn't he?
The other interesting characters are in the team around him.
Yeah.
But I have to say this: when you see him obviously involved in so much of the stunt work, Steve. On one hand, you could say, isn't this an absolutely monumental example of someone showing off? But, and it's a big but, it adds an element of realism to what you're watching, because there's no doubt you're seeing Tom Cruise fly a helicopter, jump off a plane, ride a motorcycle, drive a car, hang on to the outside of a helicopter. It's clearly him. That's not CGI. And I think it does elevate the action. It gives it a sense of this is really happening. It's not pretend. And I think I found that made a, and this much more than in the previous films, I found it really made a difference. And there's a famous scene that's been talked of a lot where he jumps off the side of a building and breaks his ankle when he reaches the other side. And that shot is in the movie.
Hate it when that happens.
Yeah. So the craft and the action sequences is so good. I actually would say to you, Steve McCabe, you should see this film just to appreciate the skill of that. And we probably, you know, I'm not a huge Tom Cruise fan, but I was able to park my reservations to one side and get a lot of enjoyment out of the film.
I shall have to give it some thought, but I'm not a huge fan. I mean look, that it's becoming a production line. This is the sixth, isn't it?
It is the sixth,
which makes you think that really they must have realized by now that these missions are clearly possible.
Yes, they are. That's true. I think this is the of the ones that I've seen. I think this is by some margin the best. Partly because it's darker. The darker tone helps it. It's not as campy and laughable, and it's just fantastic action.
There's a phrase I'm looking for here. That involves the words faint praise. Work with me.
Oh, that's a bit unfair. I just can't imagine you wouldn't be entertained. It's just, I mean, you laugh in some point. Sometimes, you know what, Steve, there was a packed cinema where I was watching it, and there was the reaction from the audience always tells you a lot, doesn't it?
This is true.
And there was a lot of ooh, ah, and sort of ooh, and even laughter, not laughter at sort of to see to witness the audacity of some of the stunt work.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, but it really, yeah.
But it almost made me think of, like, you know, looking at architecture or something. You know, you admire the technical brilliance of it without really getting anything. It doesn't speak to your soul.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a very interesting point. I think that's a very apt observation. There is an attempt to deal with that in this film by bringing back the character Julia, his wife from the early movies, and trying to give the movie some emotional direction.
Right. Okay.
Which does, I think, work. It certainly helps your connection to the film. There's no doubt about it. It doesn't really affect the story that much, but yeah, you feel more connected to the film because of it. But that's a very good point.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Yes, I'll make a note of that.
feel free to pass it off as your own.
Anyway, I'm saying to see it, and you might. I think I'm going to be.
You could be the lone voice crying out in the wilderness here. I'm not sure.
Anyway, let's leave this testosterone-laden business of Mission Impossible. Steve, there's another film which I think is more of an estrogen factor, perhaps, going to the other side of the equation. Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
Now, if ever there was an obvious title for a sequel.
Yeah, yeah.
It's perfect.
Yeah, it is perfect. And tell me, did you enjoy it?
Well, to be fair, I thought the film was pretty bloody close to perfect as well. Either I was just in a very, very good mood when I went, or I'm getting soft in my old age, or it was just utterly, utterly lovely. It was, I mean, look, I don't think we need to explain what the film was, do we, really? Because, I mean, anyone who's seen the first film knows it's basically an extended karaoke video of ABBA songs on some gorgeous, sun-drenched Greek island somewhere.
Yep.
And you know, I say that like it's a bad thing, but but they somehow take what should have been the biggest steaming bucket of cheese ever and turn it into something quite profoundly joyful.
Absolutely.
And so what we have now is... it's an interesting. It's both sequel and prequel.
Yes, I think that and it does that very well. Yeah, and it makes the story an actually a worthwhile story. It's not just some cobbled together sequel, is it, Steve? That's sort of where the story doesn't matter. Actually, the story is really, really important to what goes on.
It is. It first of all gives us the backstory to what was Meryl Streep's character in the original film in her. Donna, yes, thank you very much, in her youth, as she arrived on said Greek island, and how she met the three fellas, each of whom is a candidate to be her daughter's father. And then it also takes the story of her daughter and propels that forward. And the way it switches backwards and forwards between the various time frames, I thought was remarkably cleverly done.
I think it was superbly executed, some lovely editing, and the timing of the switches from one timeline to the other, I agree, was really nicely done. And that dual timeline, Steve, added an extra layer of emotion and pathos to what was going on.
Yes.
And really, as it was hugely fun, but it was also quite a bit of a tearjerker here and there as well.
A tiny bit, yes.
I'm playing that down, but it was. I went with my partner Sharon, and we were both sort of, you know, along for the ride, and it was
did you by any chance get some dust in your eye at some point?
Just a speck of dust here and there, Mr. McKay, but I emerged intact, I think.
But you've got Lily James, who I'm not usually particularly big on. I think she's very lightweight most of the time. Mm-hmm. Carrying the prequel aspect of it beautifully is the young Donna.
Yep.
She's got a cracking voice on her.
Absolutely.
You've got Amanda Seyfried. Again, the film notionally revolves around her, but she actually is required to do relatively little. But what she does is decent. Pierce Brosnan is... he was sounding increasingly... His accent reminded me of Aidan Gillen out of Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Which was a little bit off-putting, but he and obviously Colin Firth just ooze warmth and charm.
Yeah, and Stellan Skarsgård is also delightful, I thought.
He knows what he is. He knows he's never going to be as gorgeous or as charming as the other two, but he gets on with being a really nice bloke.
Yeah.
And then the music.
Yeah. It's catchy, it's fun, it's exuberantly performed, and the fact that it's cheesy doesn't matter, because you just have to put aside your cynicism, your skepticism, and enjoy. That's what you have to do.
That's exactly right. If you don't let yourself get swept up in the joy of this film, then seriously, you have flint in your heart.
I think that's probably right. Yes.
And, let's face it. I mean, most of the big songs were used up in the first film.
Yeah.
So we've got what we shall more politely refer to as deep cuts. It's kind of like ABBA B-sides. To a degree,
yeah, that's true. Yeah, and there's some reprises of, or is it reprise, of some of the different interpretations. Off the top of my head, was Waterloo in the first film?
Do you know, I don't think it was, but I know Dancing Queen certainly was, and the Dancing Queen in this toward the end is glorious.
It is.
I mean, let's be honest, it's barking mad. It's utterly, utterly bonkers. And if you actually stopped to dwell on that for a second, it would lose you.
Yes.
But there's so much going on. There's so much exuberant fun in this film that you say, I'm just going with it. I'm just going to get on board. Yeah. I'm going to have fun. And it's fabulous. And so, you know, they do some slightly darker moments where there's a little bit of emotional grief, where one of young Donna's paramours separates from her briefly.
Yeah.
And they play Knowing Me, Knowing You.
Yes.
Which is a strong song. I mean,
it is a strong song.
You were saying to me earlier that you thought that a lot of their songs tend to be a little bit, how should we say, a blank canvas upon which you can project your own emotions. But that not one's that not. One. That one's no, bloody not. Dark.
Yeah, but it worked very well in the film.
Yes, it did.
It did. No, I agree with you. And I just want to make a couple of little things that cropped up as we were watching the film. We see it's obviously in the first film, but we see it as the story unfolded in the beginning of how the Donna character, the Meryl Streep character, happens to form the liaisons with three men in a very short period of time.
Yes.
And Sharon I hope she doesn't mind me mentioning this. She said, you know, some people might look at that as being as the character being a bit on the promiscuous side. But I think that's a reasonable question to ask. But the flip side, I guess, is young person seeing the world, caught up in the adventure of travel, probably quite likely to happen to the best of us.
Alternatively, if it had been a fella, would anyone have said a word?
True. That's true. That's true.
If it's a bloke getting into bed with three girls, you'd be applauding him and clapping along.
Yeah, no, quite right.
And anyway, I mean, look, like I said, the moment you start analysing this film, you lose it. It's not analysable.
No, it's not.
Analyzable.
No.
But are we allowed to mention the cameo at the end?
Oh, I think we should. Particularly, yeah, I think we should. I think that it's been well signposted that she is in the film, and especially as she is coming to this country at the end of the year.
And I did want to talk about that. So obviously we're talking about Cher here.
Yes.
Who plays Amanda Seyfried's grandmother.
Yes.
And what did you make of her?
I thought two things. I thought this is my personal view. First of all, she looked, you know, as glamorous as you would expect, A. B, though, someone who had made good use of cosmetic assistance in her appearance. But, and this is the most important thing, when she sang, I liked her voice.
Oh, really?
I did. I liked that. It was deep, but it was still, to me, I thought she held the tune. I quite liked her voice, but I'm getting from your tone that did not.
Well, I couldn't get over just how utterly immobile her face is.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you're saying about her renowned use of cosmetic surgery, but there's nothing left. She's her own waxwork.
Her face. She's in the film. We can talk about it. You know, it's kind of a little bloated, really. I kind of let that go. What did you think of her voice when she sings? Has a good bit of singing to do at the end.
Yeah, and I was sitting there thinking, oh dear, this does not bode well for her appearance in Auckland.
Okay.
First of all, she's got a deeper voice than you or I have got. and it felt forced, and it felt like she couldn't put any kind of emotion or range. Yeah, she can hit the notes, but there's nothing else going on in there. I was really not impressed with Young Miss Cher at all.
Okay. Oh, well, that's good. We disagree on something. Okay,
very definitely.
Well, look, I mean, if we do get the chance to see her at the end of the year, and who knows, it would be fascinating to hear her voice live, because that was on a movie. It's been processed and
yes,
it sound edited and tweaked. And so, yeah. One other, just quickly, mention.
Before we let me just finish with Cher, though.
Yes.
Do you know what she's calling her tour?
Oh, I can't remember. No, to remind me, please.
Here we go again.
Right. Bingo.
Little bit of a tie-in.
Yes. I just wanted, because you mentioned the Knowing Me, Knowing You song, and it was a darker song.
Uh-huh.
There was one other moment which I really struck me, and it's a brief little bit of a taste of a song sung by Pierce Brosnan.
Oh, yes. Which one was it?
I think it was S.O.S.?
Yes, it was.
And it was almost unaccompanied, wasn't it? He got
pilloried for being an abominable singer
in the first film.
And I thought it was very brave that they gave him that little snatch.
Yeah. But it actually was a little bit where it required a fair bit of acting.
Yes.
And I think he pulled it off really well.
He did. And I don't think we're just simply being generous because we enjoyed the film and it's got our goodwill here. I think he actually did quite well in that bit.
Yeah, I did. I did too. I was just actually, it was a little highlight for me in that film, actually.
Yeah.
There you are. Anyway, so look, we both enjoyed it tremendously. And
can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, no, you know, if you just want an absolute fun night out, forget your worries and your woes and just have a bit of a laugh and enjoy some music and some dancing. It really, you can't go wrong.
You really, really can't, can you?
No, that's good. All right. Now
where are we going next? Because I mean,
that's the smaller screen, I hope.
Yeah, because we've had some good stuff and we've had some less good stuff. Let's go to something completely different.
Yes.
So what are we talking about next? We're talking about, that's right, we're going to say a very, very highly anticipated comedy, because it's got New Zealand comedy royalty in it.
It does.
It's got, not only has it got Taika Waititi, he of Boy, Hunt for the Wilder People, and obviously Thor Ragnarok, but it's got a Flying Concord in it.
It does, yes. Yes.
It's got Jermaine Clement, who quite frankly, is the patron saint of New Zealand these days.
That's probably a fair title to give him, bestow upon him.
So given the weapons grade celebrity that's produced Wellington Paranormal, what can we say about it?
Well, I think partly this may have suffered under the weight of expectation. This is it's been shown on TV NZ, Steve, but it's also available online on their TVNZ on demand.
Yes,
so you can watch you can go back and watch it. These are a series of quite short little episodes, comedy series.
They're about 20 minutes each. Yeah,
yeah. And basically, if you saw the movie or the mockumentary, What We Do in the Shadows, which is also the brainchild of Waititi and Clement, and which is all about the sort of vampires inhabiting Wellington, this is a direct spin-off, isn't it? Because we've got Wellington Paranormal, the two police officers involved in there, Officer O'Leary and Officer Minogue, turn up again, and they are part of a newly formed paranormal unit, the brainchild of Senior Sergeant Maka, who's convinced that Wellington's infested by all manner of supernatural beings, and he wants these two guys to get to the bottom of it. And if you've seen What We Do in the Shadows, that's what you get in this. It's that kind of it is a Kiwi attempt at some sort of an indigenous humor, I guess, Steve. It's that sort of havoc is playing out around you, and you're a bit silly and stupid, and you can't take it all in, and you somehow survive on your wits, but you don't have any wits. It's type of fare. Is that a reasonable way of summing it up?
It is, because like you say, the main characters in this are the two police officers.
Yeah.
Who really, if you remember, you know, going back to the original film, it focused on the werewolves and the vampires, I beg your pardon.
Yeah.
With the two gormless coppers kind of on the periphery.
Yeah.
And actually, as often happens when you take peripheral characters and give them a spin-off series of their own, I mean, am I allowed to say Mork and Mindy at this point?
Oh, that's quite a dramatic and bold
leap, yes.
Yes.
Or Joni Loves Chachi, dare I say. It doesn't always work to take the seasoning, to take the sprinkles on top and make a whole dish out of it.
Yeah.
And especially, and I know I'm going to alienate people saying this. In fact, they might revoke my New Zealand passport for saying this.
Mm-hmm.
What We Do in the Shadows wasn't actually very good.
Okay, that's interesting. I think it was okay. I thought I enjoyed it, but it went on too long. And I think the thing with that, and I think it's the same with this, there's an element of, this is being a bit unfair perhaps, but sort of one trick pony. The idea of the sort of low budget, silly sort of comedy played with a straight face, as you use the word gormless, that's kind of quite a good phrase, actually. These guys, they sort of play it straight while all this madness is going on around them, and they're playing it a little dumb, actually.
Yeah.
And that's on purpose. But after we watched the first three episodes, at the end of the first episode, I felt like I'd got it. But after three, I feel like, well, there's meant to be another three. I don't know if there's much more you can do with this scenario.
And I heard a similar observation being made. I can't take credit for this, but I heard people saying something very similar with the Breaker Uppers. You can imagine someone saying, well, we've got this great idea. We've got vampires in Wellington. Okay, tell me more. Well, they're vampires. And they live in Wellington.
Yeah.
And they're in Wellington. And they're vampires. And you think, okay, well, give me more. I need more. Because that's enough to maybe, possibly, make, say, a recurring character in a Saturday Night Live type show. But not really enough to sustain an entire feature film.
Yeah. And I think, and it really, or a series, Steve. And I guess it's got to work on really, well, obviously, good performances, but really good writing, doesn't it? It's the writing's got to be top of the game. And there were a few laughs to be had.
Yeah.
There was a nice line I quite liked, and I think it was the second episode. If we identify a UFO, does that mean it's just an FO?
Yes, that was cute.
That was kind of cute, and there was a bit of a reference to how the crop circles they were looking at looked like the cover of the Led Zeppelin Remasters album. And
yes.
I didn't mind that sort of stuff, but there were other attempts which are a bit lamer about how a cow got stuck up a tree, and it was because it had been there so long that the trees grew up around it, and I thought, oh, that was a bit flat. Then I don't know. So not all the jokes worked for me. Some did and some didn't, and maybe that's the nature of it. But
obviously, you and I couldn't necessarily do a whole lot better ourselves, but then
no.
We're not the two great comedy heavyweights of New Zealand.
Well, actually, that's worth a quick mention, because I paid some attention to the credits. Waititi and Clement are credited as executive producers of the three episodes that have gone to air so far.
Oh, okay.
Clement, I think, wrote the first one and maybe directed the first one, but the other two have been written and directed by other people. They probably got together and came up with the idea. Maybe there's an element of impetus from these two guys. Clement's been a bit more hands-on than Waititi has,
yeah,
but it doesn't sound so far that Waititi's really been in there doing a lot of writing or directing at all. And whether he will or not, I don't know. But wonder whether there's a little bit of a the selling of the series was, we wanted to make the most of these great names, as you said, but we're not what we've been given is not quite those guys front and center doing the business every episode.
Well, at the risk of possibly getting a little bit sort of self-indulgent and lovey-lovey here, I'm having a quick look at who wrote the second episode. It's a woman named Melanie Bracewell. This is the first fiction she's written.
Oh, okay.
She's written for 7 days, Seven Days of Sport and The Project.
Okay.
So, I mean, clearly she's capable of writing a screenplay for a sitcom, but When we're being promised that this is a Waititi and Clement enterprise, I don't know that they've necessarily got the big guns in for writing it.
No. And that's where they need them, really. I wouldn't say it's a total disaster or anything, but I ended up being a little disappointed, and I'm not particularly inclined to watch the next three episodes, I have to say. Maybe that's the most damning thing to say.
You kind of get the feeling you've probably seen them already.
Yeah. Anyway, so disappointing. Could have been better. Should have been better.
Yeah. Are we giving marks for effort?
Sam, yeah. We'll give Sam marks for it, but I'm not going to sort of say you'll be missing out on a wonderful piece of iconic New Zealand comedic culture if you miss this. I don't think that's the case.
No, it's not Wilder People. It's not Thor Ragnarok. And it's not Flight of the Conchords either.
No. Anyway, there you go.
Let's move on. I think we need to move on. Come on, cleanse the palate, Simon.
We shall. Let's go back to the big screen again. This is a film that's actually been around for a little while now, but this is our first chance to have a chat about it.
It is, and now this is the latest Marvel superhero nonsense. Ant-Man and the Wasp. Now, Europe usually are the Marvel sticker-upper for it out of the two of it, aren't you?
Yes, I usually am. That's true.
So, and this obviously hasn't been quite as huge as, you know, Captain Avenger and all the rest.
Captain Avenger.
I don't know. I've lost track of them. There's so many. But I mean, it's certainly not had the impact of, say, a Guardians of the Galaxy or a Deadpool either. But what did we think of it?
Well, so this was the film, the first film after the hugely successful Avengers Infinity War. Now, I know we shouldn't be caught up by money too much, Steve, but the fact is the Infinity War has made more than $2 billion. So I think it's the third or fourth most successful film of all time.
Yeah, soon to be retitled Infinity Box Office.
Yes. So how you could possibly follow that up is a good question. And I think what Marvel's done here is to make is purposefully put out a much smaller sort of movie.
I think that's probably wise, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is wise, and it's focused more narrowly. It's the return of the Ant-Man character. Paul Rudd was introduced in a standalone film like 2 or 3 years ago. He's a more family-friendly sort of character. The film is a lot about the family, his family and his relationships, and there's a bit of adventure, but basically it's a small, and the character shrinks, so when I say it's a small-scale film, I'm referring to both, and... But I enjoyed it because it was just a bit of fun. It was a bit diverting. It wasn't so serious. It does neatly, though, tie into the Infinity War story, especially at the end in a post-credit scene. It was just nothing that would stay in your memory for a long, long time, but diverting enough and entertaining enough. I think you have seen it, haven't you?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was thinking this afternoon about we were going to be recording this podcast this evening. I was thinking about, you know, well, okay, Mamma Mia, yeah, I can say this about it, and Wellington Paranormal, I can say that. And then I looked down at your email saying we're going to talk about Ant-Man and the Wasp. And I went, oh, yeah, that's right. I saw that as well, didn't I? And it had so utterly escaped my memory.
Okay.
It made so little impact because, yeah, I mean, like you said, they can't. They'd be insane to try to do another Infinity War. That would be madness.
Yes.
But they've definitely gone much lower end, and I don't know how well it worked.
Well, from Marvel's point of view, they would be probably disappointed in its box office. It's done, I mean, it, you know, we're so used to these films making so much money. This is, I think it made, last time I looked, about $400 million, which is still pretty decent, but it's way, way below what most of the other films have been doing in the last year or two. So they might feel they haven't quite got the formula right this time. I guess we've just seen so many of them, haven't we, Steve? I am a fan. I am disposed towards them. I enjoyed it, but yes, it's beginning to just trying to make, give the audience enough variety in the storytelling is a real big ask.
I know, at the moment. It felt dreadfully formulaic to me. You know, so Paul Rudd's character Scott Lang, who is Ant-Man. Mm. He's got that, oh, I'm a superhero, but I'm a little bit goofy as well shtick.
Yeah, that's true.
It feels fairly well rehearsed. You've got Michael Peña as his comic sidekick.
Yeah.
You've got what's his name? Michael Douglas.
Yes.
As the grown up in the room.
Yes.
And frankly, I don't think he even broke a sweat, did he, really? I mean, he...
Yeah, I did. I was having a bit of a question mark about him too, actually, just a little bit, yeah.
He phoned that one in.
Maybe. Michelle Pfeiffer turns up?
She does. I mean, they don't really give her a huge amount to do because she's been stuck in the quantum realm, whatever the hell that is. I mean, seriously, my inner physics teacher died a million deaths watching this film. It's probably better not to dwell on on the idea that you can go through a quantum tunnel to get to the quantum realm. In fact, at one point, Scott Lang does ask, do you guys just put the word quantum in front of everything? I mean, yeah, they actually do, don't they?
Yeah.
But it was it was pleasant and it was agreeable, but it had no substance to it.
Yeah.
At all.
Okay. One aspect worth just a quick comment, Steve, is we mentioned Paul Rudd playing Scott Lang, the Ant-Man, but it's Ant-Man and the Wasp. Mm-hmm. And actually, the sort of the kick-ass hero is the Wasp in this film. Evangeline Lilly plays Hope, and she is the much more the sort of superhero you would expect. You know, the more aggressive,
yes,
combat-ready sort of a superhero who'll take on all comers. It's a bit of a reversal of what maybe the traditional views of men and women superheroes. So that's kind of a little refreshing. And I think coming up in the not too distant future, that Steve. There was going to be another Marvel film with a woman as the central sole character in the film. It's called Captain Marvel. There's so many captains here, I know it's hard to keep up. But
yes,
they
need to promote one of these. They do need to promote one of these to a major or something, just so we can keep track of them.
Yeah, I know. That's exactly. Anyway, I can't disagree with you too much.
Yeah, I mean, should we find some good things to say about it?
Well, okay.
Sort of the another strong female character, the sort of semi villain Ghost.
Oh yes,
played by Hannah John Kamen.
Yeah,
British actress I wasn't familiar with, but I'd like to see more of her. I thought she brought a strong amount of nastiness to the film. She put a lot into it. She had a fairly thin character to play.
Yeah.
But I quite enjoyed what she did with it. And I was delighted to see Walton Goggins redeeming himself.
Yeah, he plays a guy called Sonny Birch, and he was good. Yeah, he was good.
Yeah, last time we saw him was in, what was it called? Tomb Raider.
Oh, yes.
Which, I mean, we say that Michael Douglas phoned this one in. Walton Goggins, I mean, I don't know what he was thinking on that film. It was wasted. But here he got to be really nicely evil.
Yeah, that was a nice little role. I want to ask you one other thing about, because I've noticed there's been a bit of commentary on this, Steve.
Go on.
You mentioned Michael Pena playing one of Paul Rudd's sidekicks.
Yeah, yeah.
They bring back the three sidekicks from the first film. So
yes,
Pena,
they do, don't they? Yeah.
There's David Dasmalchian, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it, who's kind of a Russian guy, and a black guy called Dave, who's the rapper, T.I. So,
yes.
And this is something you've alluded to in some earlier podcasts about the tendency to slot in some actors who represent different ethnic groups to kind of bolster the the PC worthiness of a film and its cast. Did you get any sense of that in this film? I mean, this isn't the first time these actors have been in this role, but did it feel a little forced to you or not?
Well, I mean, any time that you do something that's marked, then you kind of have to justify it a little bit. Having a black character, I don't think is particularly marked because, I forget what the percentage of these is in the US, but there's a decent number of black people there, so it's not remarkable that you would have a black person in...
And a lot of Hispanic people as well.
Especially in California.
Yeah.
However, Dasmalchian, I mean, that's going to be, what, an Armenian name, I guess? But he plays a Russian, basically, doesn't he? Or a Bulgarian, or those things.
Or something like that.
A sorted Eastern European. That's marked. That's significant, and yet there's never any sense of why he's there. And it does feel like, you know, why does he need to be there? In the same way, you know, the Ghost character, why does she need to be English? I mean, yeah, have more women actors in, because let's face it, we need more women because the world is. I mean, did you know there's actually half the world are women? Who knew? You'd never guess it from films, would you?
No, you wouldn't.
But I'll tell you, why have an English character in there? It does seem a little bit unnecessary. Yeah. It does seem a little bit box-ticky sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a good way. Box-ticky, that's the phrase, yeah. Anyway, so, but there is some inventive little, some, you know, special effects as the characters go from big to small and it's fun enough. I mean, I wasn't bored or anything, but it was not as intense. Having come from a very intense sort of film like Infinity War, which with all the whiz bang and the cast coming out of your ears, which way you look, it was more low key and maybe a bit harder to get enthused about.
Yes, I can go with that. Like I say, it felt like a place filler.
Yeah, it had a bit of Anyway, okay, I think we've done that one, I think. Thank you very much, sir.
I think we could do a moving on a little bit here, yeah.
I think we could. I just mentioned, you know, Steve and I have these chats. Often, if you want to sort of follow up, apart from listening to us on the podcast, we post a lot of written reviews of the films and music that we chat about. So go to our website, cravepodcast.com, and there you'll see, among other things, a review I've posted for a movie we're not going to talk about this week because I think we're running out of time, but it's Denzel Washington in the second film of The Equalizer. It's called The Equalizer 2. This is that old British TV series, Steve, from was it the 80s and 90s with Edward Woodward, The Equalizer, and it's Denzel Washington's take on that.
Yes.
So you can find a bit more about that on the website, cravepodcast.com.
Yeah. I always had a feeling that his name wasn't real.
Well, apparently his father was called Denzel.
No, not him. I'm Edward Woodward.
Oh, Edward Woodward.
That kind of. I think his parents were having a laugh if that was not fair. If that's his real name, that's not nice.
Yeah.
You definitely go with Ted, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Would Edward Woodward? Yes, I know it's. Yeah.
Well, Edward Woodward would.
He would.
So anyway, so the other thing you'll find out on our website at cravepodcast.com is what's coming up in the near future, and there's some interesting announcements coming up in the near future.
Yes, please do take us through one or two of them, Mr. McKay.
Well, we've got James, the British band. They're from Manchester, you know.
Who would have known?
I may have mentioned that in the past.
Maybe.
Partly because I'm a bit of a fan myself, to be perfectly honest. I got the chance to chat with their singer, Tim Booth, before they came over last time a couple of years ago. They're going to be here almost exactly 2 years later. November the 11th, they're at the Power Station in Auckland. Then they're going down to Christchurch to play the Bedford Marquee on the 12th. And we will have an interview with their bassist and founding member, Jim Glennie, coming up very, very shortly. So that's a good one to look out for.
Okay. And I see the tour. I'm not sure if you've mentioned this already, Steve, previously. A band I saw for the first time last year and really enjoyed them. 21 Pilots coming back.
Yes. I was saving that till the end. I was going to impress you with that.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
But I remember you spoke very, very highly of those guys, didn't you?
I did. It was a type of music that I was unfamiliar with. I had no didn't really know what I was in for, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. They were very impressive live, a hell of a show. Rap music, but expertly produced and presented, dramatically so. And I was about a million years outside the age group of most people there, but it didn't matter. And it was great. It was really good. So apparently they've got some new material as well this time around, Steve, I think. So should be good.
So that's going to be your Christmas present this year, Simon. Friday the 21st of December.
Ooh.
Okay. At Spark Arena.
Okay.
Yep. I might have to fight you for the review tickets for that one.
All right. I'll let you go if you want to go. Okay.
We shall talk. Now, slightly less of the moment. Were you ever a fan of The Church?
That's one of those sort of bands that in this part of the world I would have heard about them, but I didn't really sit down and have a good listen to them. So I actually have to plead some ignorance. But I've heard of them, yes, and I know that they were significant in your part, where you were from originally. Is that right, Steve, The Church?
I was vaguely aware of them. I mean, they're an Australian band.
Oh, okay. Well, for some reason, I thought they're British. That shows you how little I know.
Well, I think you're possibly thinking of Lords of the New Church.
I don't know.
But anyway, apparently, and obviously neither is there much about this, is 30 years ago, they released a particularly successful album called Starfish.
Okay.
And so to mark the 30th anniversary, because this is the thing that bands do these days, they're going to be playing the album in its entirety.
Okay.
Yeah. Tuesday the 4th of December, Spark Arena.
Okay.
If that's what floats your boat. And it sounds like it might not do.
it'll float someone's boat.
Yes. I'd say it going kind of in another completely other direction. Yeah. Here's a band that are, I don't know, living on past glories, to say the least of it. UB40.
Now I think they probably are. I think they've done a tour or two here over the years. UB40 and their various incarnations.
Well, that's the big issue. There are two UB40s.
Yeah.
Now, right. and the one that I covered a couple of years ago, I went to the press conference and met Ali Campbell, the original singer. And he's all, because they are now called UB40 featuring Ali, Astro and Mickey is the official name of the band. And I asked them, would they ever consider getting back together with the other UB40 who are touring, including his brother, singing now. And I thought he was going to have a go at me because he was like quite vehement.
Okay.
That no, there will be no rapprochement with the other UB40.
Oh, dear.
But they are doing the 40th anniversary tour.
Wow. Okay.
Exactly. So if you happen to be anywhere in January or February, anywhere near Napier, Waitangi, Nelson, or Christchurch, then you know, all cynicism aside, they do actually put on a decent show.
Okay.
You know, I mean, everyone knows Red Red Wine.
Yeah,
But you when you go and see them and they'll start playing other songs like, you know, Rat in the Kitchen and Kingston Town and One in Ten, songs that you forgot you knew.
Right, right, okay.
And I know I'm not really selling it because it's not really my kind of music, but they're right. And the politics of the band and the other version of the band do get in the way a little bit, but they're actually not. They're actually quite a good live act, to be honest. I mean, they've been doing it for long enough.
Yeah,
but I'll tell you who's been doing it for longer.
Well, I was going to mention someone, but yeah, I think I might know who you're going to talk about.
Go on, you take it.
Well, we've mentioned him before, but we haven't mentioned him for some time, and I think his shows are only a few weeks away now. Are you thinking about Mr. Dylan?
Oh no! Oh no! Possibly even longer ago than that.
Oh, really? Oh, I know. Now I know who you're thinking about. Well, but I was just going to quickly say, I haven't seen much about the Dylan shows. There's one in Auckland on the 26th of August, one in Christchurch on the 28th. I mean, this is one of the great artists of the 20th century and even into the 21st. Is he kind of just fading out into the sunset? Because I don't know if there's been much attention paid to this visit. Have you seen much? I haven't seen much written about it or talked about it.
He's not getting massive coverage. I think partly there's the assumption that he doesn't need very much.
Well, there is that.
He's not doing a stadium. He's doing two arenas. So he's got half the tickets to sell.
But I know that last time I saw him two or three, well, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and he played the Civic Theatre in Auckland, which is very
really?
Small.
Wow.
And yeah. So I think to go from there to Spark Arena in Auckland is actually moving up.
Yeah.
I wonder how many people will turn up. Because he's renowned for not necessarily putting on a very vibrant stage show. I mean, the songs are there and he reworks them. They don't necessarily sound like the favourites you think they're going to sound like.
But at the same time, as we said, he is royalty.
He is. He's utter royalty.
He is a singular presence, and he will damn well do what he wants, I think, to be honest.
Yeah. And he's got the Nobel Prize to prove it.
Absolutely.
But anyway, no. I know. So back to what you were talking about.
All this pales. Pales into insignificance compared to Engelbert Humperdinck. He's coming back to New Zealand.
And you were talking about the title of Cher's tour, the title of this tour. It's an interesting way. It's a guy who must be in his, I don't know, 75 plus. I don't know. And he's called it the Man I Want to Be.
Oh,
tour.
Yes. You'd think he'd have figured that one out by now, really,
I
wouldn't
think
you?
So.
Yeah. So, especially, I mean, I'm assuming that's not his real name. So.
Yes. Yeah.
So you have to wonder what the hell's going on there. But anyway, to his eternal credit, he's actually doing. You know, a little bit of a spin around here. He's doing a few days in Australia, but he's also doing Auckland, well, Takapuna to be exact, Christchurch, and Wellington. And for a man who's in his 80s...
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
You know, I don't know if there's like wheeling him out on a little trolley or something. But I mean, I'm looking at the poster, and either that's some of the worst photoshopping and airbrushing I've ever seen, or he's had more work done than Cher.
Yes.
Could kind of go either way, couldn't it, to be fair?
I'm just having a quick look at if I can see his age here, because I'm just, while you were doing that, according to Wikipedia, he's 82.
He's 82.
Wow.
Wow, God bless him.
God bless him. Wow. Okay. Anything else while we're?
I mean seriously. Yes. How can you?
How
top,
can you follow that?
How can you top Engelbert Humperdinck? I mean that's it. That's just as good as he's ever going to get, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, all right, lovely. So Steve, Yeah, a lot coming up. We like to hear from all these millions of people who listen to us, don't we? And if you do want to drop us a line and say anything good, bad, or in the middle, you can email us, podcast@cravepodcast.com.
We can be reached all over social media. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Crave Podcast.
Cunningly titled.
Absolutely.
Mm. So, till next time, I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Certainly is. Well, I think that went fairly well.